Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
And you talk about the crazy difference. Undercover work, as we like to say, it's a volunteer sport. However, when I got hired, when Lou was in the academy class that started maybe 3 months before mine back in 98. So we were in the first wave of that big hire. The only reason in our minds somebody would want to join ATF is because you want to do undercover work. You want to do just dismantling these violent crews with no regard for human life. Why else would you want this job?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph on the Morning. Let me tell you, we're doing this in the morning, and it has been an ordeal. You know, I've never made any bones about it. I'm not a tech guy when it comes to this kind of, especially this technical recording stuff. And our guest today, he and I have been battling this now for almost an hour to get it to work, but we finally got it. So welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you folks bearing with us. We've got a guy who was recommended to me, and we'll talk a little bit more about that here in just a minute, but he's a 35-year law enforcement professional, now retired, has been through some unbelievable events in his career. We're going to get into a couple of those. This is going to be a really, really good interview. Remember, for those that you have been around for a while, when Morgan was here, we used to have that saying, get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Today's one of those episodes. So it's my true pleasure to welcome Eric Emsberger. Welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Steve. Glad to be here.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for coming on, and thanks for bearing with me this morning so we get through all this technical stuff.
It's all good. It's like a fugitive hunt. We always got to have the phantom sighting before the real thing.
Hey, whatever it takes to make it work, right? I got all kinds of help worksheets pulled up on another laptop here trying to figure out what the heck we're doing. But it's working right now, so let's go with that. You folks know that every week we like to have our small town police blotter. And like I always do, I wait till the night before and hit our guest. Hey, would you mind doing this? And I sent it to Eric last night. And just like every other guest on here, he didn't hesitate. He read the article I sent him. It's hilarious. And he agreed to do it. So before we get into that, I just read our disclaimer. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. We take our stories here very serious. But we're never going to miss the opportunity to have a good laugh at some of the idiots that are out there that should have chosen another occupation than being a criminal. So Eric happens to live in Missouri, and he has a good story. I think you're going to find a little humorous. All up to you, brother.
Good to go. Well, Steve, this story is brought to us from Lactaid sponsor.
That tells you right there what's going to go on, right?
apparently, a fugitive found a good place to hide. Good place to hide, bad place to get caught. But on the search, he apparently gave like a level 10 fart and said, take that one and paint it green. And he got grabbed. They said, yeah, even hard of hearing. Cops. Yeah, we heard that. And that was that. So now this guy's got a great story to tell in prison. Yeah, oh, how I got caught.
Yeah. That is out. I mean, it's just so funny.
Yeah. You know,
a lot of times when I go find these stories, Eric, I'll go through several stories before I find one I think, you know, sounds good. That one popped up yesterday, the very first one, and I thought, that's it.
Yeah, that was actually from Liberty Police Department just north of Kansas City. And I've worked with that department when I was running the gun squad in Kansas City. Fantastic police department. Good people, good gear, completely responsive. They are out there looking all the time.
Yep. And obviously they have very good hearing.
and good hearing. Yeah, smell too, I guess.
Yeah, well, I wonder if they'd had a dog out there. I wonder how the dog would react it.
Yeah. Dogs like that kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. All right, so thank you for playing along on that, Eric. And let's go over to Florida, where we have absolutely zero problems coming up with stupid criminals. And this one, this title, Get Ready for Court Jester. Court jester. Okay. So, upset at the noise of a landscaper's lawnmower, the noise that it was making, a Florida man, retrieved a dagger from his car and threatened the worker with a weapon, according to cops, who say the accused was wearing a full jester costume during the incident and arrest. And I saw a picture of him, and he looks like a moron. So the landscaper, Brian Hansen, was mowing two separate lawns on a St. Petersburg street. And I don't know what it is about that Tampa St. Pete area, but it just seems like they have way more than their share of idiots over there. But he's out there doing his job. He was confronted by Anthony Marzola, 51 years old. He's the guy in the jester costume, and he lives in that neighborhood. According to investigators, Marzola became upset with the sound of the mower and retrieved a 12-inch dagger-style blade from a vehicle, began walking towards the victim. Marzola was allegedly pointing the dagger at Hansen and yelling that he cannot be mowing. Okay. It's not like he was doing this in the middle of the night. This happened at 2:45 in the afternoon. Marzola advanced until the victim positioned his stand-on mower to be between him and the defendant. And this was all witnessed by neighbors. The defendant was wearing a full jester costume during the incident and arrest, according to St. Pete Police. While the report does not indicate why Marzola was at home wearing a jester outfit in the middle of the day, then maybe he's waiting for the men in the white coats to come by, it seems likely that the getup was related to his operation of the psychedelic jester smoke shop, which recently relocated from Seminole to St. Pete. So poor Marzola, he's charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, which is a felony. He's booked into custody. He's in county lockup. The judge says bond $15,000, and he's not allowed to talk to the guy cutting the grass anymore.
Hey, Steve, thank God they're stupid. We'd never catch any of them.
Low-hanging fruit, man. That's what we talk about. You're so right. So, well, that puts everybody in a good mood, especially that fart story. That's one of the better ones we've had on in a while. You know, I mean, just think about it. You couldn't hold it in. You know, the cops are right there on top of you. And you couldn't hold it in. There you go. Mother Nature. Okay. So how I met Eric here is through a former guest here on the show, Mr. Lou Velozzi, retired ATF agent. Lou was here when was one of our original guests over 4 years ago in episode 4. And I believe, let's see, your episode here, Eric, is episode 215. So that's how long ago. Lou and I have become really, really close friends, met his family. He knows Connie. And Lou, just thank you. If you're listening, brother, thank you so much for the introduction here. We had a pre-call, which typically lasts, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And Eric and I were on the phone for an hour and a half, telling war stories back and forth and just basically having a good time. So, and that's just part of that law enforcement brotherhood and sisterhood you hear me talk about all the time. So, Eric, if you would, just to get this started, tell us a little bit about where you grew up, your family dynamics, your background. Did you know where you went to high school? Did you play sports in high school, college, anything you want to tell us about your family?
Sure. Grew up originally just east of New York City in Long Island, typical 60s family, divorced. Like just about every kid in my grade school, getting divorced was like the vogue thing at that time. So the hardship of that and living with my mom and moving from residence to residence every 60 days, two steps ahead of the law, actually was good preparation for doing undercover work, law enforcement in general. I wound up in probably right around sixth, seventh, eighth grade, living in a Section 8 building, a project building, in the city of Albany, which is, and it might as well be Brooklyn, horrible. The school that I went to later shut down due to the unabated level of violence in a school. It was literally, it was like one of those Tom Berenger, The Substitute movies, out of control. Teachers scared to death of these kids getting in fights every single day, which more good training. So that was and just about everybody, this is seventh and eighth grade, just about everybody wound up in jail that were my little circle of friends.
Wow.
Yeah. My dad goes through trying to get custody of myself and my brothers, you know, typical judge in the '70s, kid has to stay with the mom no matter how bad the circumstance. But I raised my hand in ninth grade. I said, "Hey, come and get me. I'm done with this." And then my brothers came shortly after, and then we had to reacclimate to normal society. But I got put in a great school. Thank God, set me up for success academically. And in ninth grade, in this fantastic school in Westchester County, just north of New York City, ninth grade career day, state trooper comes in. 40 minutes later, that was it. I knew exactly what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Wow.
And got a chance to do it.
Holy cow, he had a real influence on you, huh?
A mesmerizing delivery. And I mean, I guess he got given that detail for a reason. Hey, I need you to go talk to these high school kids all day today and tell them what we do. And I'm sure he was picked for that detail for his skill in talking to youngsters. And that was it. That was it.
Was it something he said or his appearance or a combination of everything?
It was command presence squared away. I don't think he smiled, dead serious. And I went up to him after the class, as did others. And I said, "This is what I want to do. Tell me, give me the path. You tell me what I got to do and I'm going to do it." And back in the '70s. And he said, "You got to take every math class you can. You got to become a wordsmith, a perfectionist at writing reports." He said, this is uniform state trooper. He goes, "The pen puts people in jail more than anything else. Your reports have to be tight." He said, "Take every math class, teaches you how to think logically." And I did that. I took math as electives in college and constant writing courses, how to write. So it was a huge influence. And the next year, 10th grade, my father and my stepmother buy a motel. So that's now the family business, 24 hours a day for us. And I happened to run into a guy this high school had a class A marching band program of all things. We were marching every day like it was the Marines. Really great instruction. But I meet this guy. His name is John Letney, lifelong friend now. And we're talking about police work. And he says, "Hey, are you interested in becoming a police cadet?" I'm a police cadet in this small town police department. But after you go through some basic training, you can go out unarmed in uniform as a cadet in high school and go on patrol with these single man cars. And you'll know if this is what you want to do. I'm like, I'm in. I'm all in.
I like it.
Well, Letney goes on to become a uniformed officer. He becomes a police chief at a few places. He goes on to be the president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
Wow.
His star rose. Fast forward to, you know, he has his first son and I'm holding this little bambino. Fast forward, He wants to be an ATF agent, and he was in the State Department at the time. And I'm like, game on. And he's now an agent. So, but the police cadet listening to that trooper for 40 minutes, it just set the trajectory for what I wanted. And I assumed I was going to be a uniformed police officer until the age of 63, mandatory mm-hmm. retirement in New York. I did it for less than 18 months and course change. I knew investigations was really what I wanted to do. Little course correction. And that's what launched me into New York City Department of Investigation for a few years. Became a detective in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office almost 9 years. And then on to ATF. Actually, when I was in New York City Department of Investigation, a lot of quick hitter undercover stuff. Posing as a corrupt city employee, posing as a corrupt attorney, and a lot of reps, getting very comfortable with drilling into the cesspool that was New York City. I was doing so many UCs, and these were not dangerous UCs like later in life. These were, I'm dealing with people that want to corrupt New York City employees, businesses. My bosses say, nobody else is doing the number that you're doing. And we're going to recommend you to go to the ATF undercover school. They really have the corner on what you need to do. And they have a 1 week road show, 16-hour days, and we're putting you in it. I had never even heard of ATF. But after that 1 week school, it was like listening to that trooper. It's like all in.
You drank the Kool-Aid.
I'm going to go to ATF. It took me another 10 years to get there. But yeah, ATF to me, just like DEA was to you, it was like the brass ring. ATF, really the best way to describe ATF, the last of the federal in-your-face street cops. Like, that's what we did. We did a few things very well. And we never tried to be a million things to a million people. You're inch thick, you're a mile wide. Things that we did really well. Home invasion crews, pattern arm robbery crews, of course, firearms trafficking, and everything that drags you into. Any drug trafficking organization using firearms in furtherance of their operation, which led me to do awesome stuff with DEA throughout the career. And I really felt I never had a job. I would have paid the government to do this mission set. That's how much I loved it.
Fantastic. I agree with you 100% because I've said on here numerous times, if you find a job that you like, you'll never work a day in your life. And you and I were fortunate enough to find that job. It was when I retired, my oldest son's like, Dad, you are DEA. What the heck are you going to do?
Yeah. By the way, you and Javier, that case, I mean, everybody read the book, watch Narcos. That's, you'll be applauded for centuries to come, putting your head in the lion's mouth, the crocodile's mouth. When you talk about, like when you interviewed Billy Queen, the name of his book, Under and Alone, help is not coming. Yeah. I'm 1,000 miles away from Conus. We're it, you know, we got to make our own luck every day. And you guys did it. You did mission completion. So I say, bravo. But well done.
You don't know how much that means coming from somebody like you. It's very humbling for you to say that. Thank you. Just by the grace of God, we survived and we're here talking about you today. I do appreciate you saying that.
And as a side note, my wife, now a retired federal prosecutor, and she went all the way up the food chain to the first assistant. When we said, and this was after the series Narcos had ended, we say, hey, this Narcos series, this is going to be great. And we start watching. my wife after that episode of that extended abuse of that female.
Yeah.
I'm not watching any more of this. And this is my wife. She prosecuted the MS-13 crew in Long Island that murdered a mom and her toddler in literally cold blood. The girl comes to this meeting, says, I'll bring my toddler. Surely they won't do anything crazy if I have my kid. Yeah. They killed both of them.
That's horrible.
In horrible fashion. Yeah. She prosecuted that. She's my bride, literally stone cold in the courtroom. She was all that impressive. Yeah. I've watched her. Poof. I'm just, I never want to be on the bed and Q&A with her.
Understood.
I'm not going to win that one.
Yeah. You know, and I told you when we were talking earlier this week that my sister, who lived in Tennessee, she's passed away since, but she started watching the Narcos series and she got to that same scene and she called me. She's like, I'm not watching anymore. You know, and I said, well, you know, it's a lot of Hollywood and it's a lot of made up stuff. The important thing is that we took him down in the end. So it's very bad graphic.
Bad things happen to good people a lot. That's why we have jobs.
Yeah. You know, I don't think Javier would mind me mentioning this, but if he does, I apologize, Javier. But he has not watched the entire Narcos series yet. And the first two, the first two seasons are about him and me. And then the third season is about him going after the Cali cartel because he went back to Colombia a second time. And he said he started watching it and started having some flashbacks and anxious feelings. And so, you know, God bless him. He's dealing with it and he's not letting things like that take control of his life. So he just has chosen not to watch it.
Just the fact that America produces citizens willing to go into harm's way months, years at a time, help is not coming. We're it. America is replete with those kinds of examples. And even us in the business, when we see it, like we expect good work, excellent work every day. But you guys were beyond that. It's almost without equal. And it probably does have some equals because, you know, guys we've worked with have done things.
Oh, we've had a lot of the ATF guys on here that were doing the deep cover stuff. You know, Jay Dobbins.
Yep. Yeah, Jay
Chris Bird. Had Chrisser come on. Mm-hmm. Lou Velozzi, Billy Queen, Ken Croke even had him come on. I mean, your agency's full of studs that I wouldn't do any of that stuff.
Steve, and you talk about the crazy difference. Undercover work, as we like to say, it's a volunteer sport.
Right.
It's a volunteer sport. However, when I got hired, when Lou was in the academy class that started maybe 3 months before mine back in 98. So we were in the first wave of that big hire. The only reason in our minds somebody would want to join ATF is because you want to do undercover work. You want to do just dismantling these violent crews with no regard for human life. Why else would you want this job? And then as the years went, those kind of people were not the 100% of the academy class anymore. There were, you know, I always like to say we don't hire introverts. Like there's other places like the post office maybe. But, you know, I started to see a little bit degrading of the people's agents' motivation of why they wanted to come into this outfit. Now, there we have a world-class arson and explosive program, and guys literally came in to do that, but they approached that discipline with the same zest that guys like you and me went after, you know, the other types of crime. Yeah. And there was like a problem person, and they said, you know, bosses, big bosses above me, what are we going to do with this? And I'm like, well, Why don't we start with the panel interview? Four people went thumbs up. And they went to an academy. The academy staff knew. Hey, if you can't qualify at the ATF Academy, they'll shoot a pallet of ammunition to get you to that mark. And I'm like, the academy gave them a thumbs up, knowing full well this is a mediocre at best product. And then they did not excel in their first assignment. And it's like, what are you going to do? It's like, hey, can just bring the G-Ride back when you retire.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
Luckily, very few of those.
Yes.
But it was unmotivating to see when you contrast it to like the guys Lou and I were hired with and the senior vets that came in to teach us. Those guys, I'd like to say we were, you know, awesome. These instructors that came in, Bayless, Carlos Canino, these were like titans of industry, captains of industry. And there was no fluff. There was the ruffled feather Olympics were alive and well.
Yeah. I understand.
And just like listening to that trooper way back when, like Canino, Bayless, all those guys that came in, edge of your seat. I'm like, oh my God, I landed at the right place at the right time because this is exactly what I want to do. And yeah, got to do it.
It was a blast. It was a blast. And it's, yeah, and when you retire, you know, it's, I'm really worried that, I was a cop for 38 years. I don't know how to do a lot of other things. I mean, fortunately, the Narcos thing came along and that developed into our speaking business, which gives us the opportunity to hang out with law enforcement around the world now. So it's, you know, I live just like you. We live vicariously through what the real cops are doing now. But at least you still maintain that brotherhood. I go to the gym several days a week and I know some of the trainers there, but the other people that I know in the gym, and I went this morning, it's packed. The only people I really know are other cops. And cops will introduce me to cops.
And that's the discipline. I think it's the factor that Social Security may run out of money paying us out someday because I plan on living forever.
Yeah, there you go.
If I can, every single day. The day is not right unless it starts with PT. And yeah. I did it in the driveway this morning and it's every day. It just sets you up for success and it's an easy win. Did that stack the win, feel good. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm paying here in retirement for thinking I knew how to lift weights when I was a cop because I didn't. And, you know, some of the activities you get involved with that later in life start hurting, arthritis sets in, you know, I've had cervical fusion in my neck. I've had to reattach my bicep on my right arm. I've had the torn rotator cuff over here and tendons and ligaments torn and ripped and things just freaking hurt.
There's no way around that. However, look at guys our age that PT was an afterthought. Their volunteer sport was Costco sheet cakes and they've got real problems. Nothing compared to the aches and pains that we have.
Yeah. You know, I mean, mentally I don't feel my age, but, my wife reminds me of my age sometimes. Hey, before we get by here, where'd you go to college at?
The College of Knowledge, John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. And that was a college for law enforcement. There were no sports, no football field, no grass, as a matter of fact. Two buildings in Midtown Manhattan. And a lot of times guys were in uniform. They go to class in the bag. I just got off of work. I'm about to, you know, it's like, and nobody looked twice. It's not like, a regular college or university. It was phenomenal. Again, top-notch people. The only instructors were people that excelled in whatever discipline in law enforcement that they came from. NYPD, yeah. The federal agencies, top notch. So when you took classes from these guys and gals, you were hearing it, not academic regurgitation. These are guys that lived it. I had one instructor, Daniel Vona. I don't know if that rings a bell. This guy had been a Green Beret, POW, had his teeth drilled out. But then goes into law enforcement and he goes right back to Southeast Asia, the Golden Triangle. And I'm so interested in this. And he says, hey, here's a book, international something. It was like a book that I had to go to the New York City Public Library to even find this book, their only copy. I still got it in my basement bookcase. They didn't get that one back. And I'm doing these little reports and he goes, I've sat down with this guy before and I was on the team that drilled that. And I'm like, my God, it's like,
who don't you know?
Yeah. And he was only like 5'5". I mean, tiny little guy. But when this guy spoke,
yeah,
unbelievable. He comes to another buddy of mine. We're both in John Jay together. Guy named Matt Allen. He went on to be like the deputy director of customs, like he another guy that went far. And so Vona goes to us. He goes, hey, I'm putting together a counterterrorism seminar at West Point for a week. If you guys give me a hand just doing some stuff, I'll put you up at the Hotel Thayer on West Point, eat for free, drink for free. And you're going to get to sit in the back row and listen to these people. And so one of the guys that was a prominent speaker, Richard Marcinko, who had just started SEAL Team 6, the guy that invented that. And again, edgier seat. We were drinking with that guy every single night. And the stories. Yeah, again, it's like if I was going to go the military route, that guy, after 3 or 4 nights hanging out, that would have been it. That would have been what I did.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And John Jay College, man, it has a fantastic reputation within the law enforcement field. I'm a Southern boy. But before you got into law enforcement, did you do an internship through the college?
I did an internship through the New York City Department of Investigation. And if you wanted an internship and John Jay was a requirement, you had to do an internship. Most of us did a few, but that's where I got put, New York City Department of Investigation. And I saw what these investigators were doing and the gear. These guys had like almost like a black budget, whatever the top-notch gear of the early 80s, they had it. And very a lot cool. of it. So had that in the back of my mind. And I had done my first 2 uniform deals as a police officer. And I decided if I don't go back and get this degree, I'm never going to get this degree. So I stopped everything for 2 semesters and 23 credit semesters back to back, got the degree. I called my old boss at Department of Investigation literally the day after I got my degree. And he goes, I have a desk waiting for you today, tomorrow morning. Come on in.
Wow.
And that started 4 years of that. And then on to the Brooklyn DA. But my buddy, Matt Allen, got an internship at Customs, you know, back in the days when it was called Customs. And then after all the name changes, he told me, he worked with guys, I don't even turn my head unless I hear the word Customs. It's like, I'm not responding to this new agency title.
Yeah, that's funny
stuff.
When you were doing that, the Department of Investigation, and you're doing the undercover, did you ever run into any mafia related figures, people?
Traditional LCN, La Cosa Nostra, the Italians, no. However, I ran into Asian organized crime that had figured out footholds to get on the playing field, corrupting New York City agency personnel to get permits to do this, permits to do that. And then they just, then they figured out how to counterfeit the permits. And, you know, when you go to Lower Manhattan back in those days and you would see 50 tables of people just selling stuff. Oh, got a license. Yeah, you got a counterfeit license. And we became expert at spotting them and trying to turn these people, who's making them, where you getting this stuff from. I tell you, a good undercover. Again, Asian guy, and he thinks I'm an attorney working for an agency that issued the type of permits that he wanted to get. And he's taking me to these like real ethnic restaurants. That's where these meats are. I'm eating good. Not my cover team. They're not eating good. And it got to be a point where now the NYPD guys that were in the Department of Investigation, they're coming out on the cover team. It's like, you're into something here, kid. I'm like, I think I am. And then one night, you talk about how does a great investigation get flushed down the toilet? Now this guy that's whining and dining me, he genuinely likes me. And, you know, because I am basically feeding him like exactly what he wants to hear. Like I'm creating this illusion of what I can do for him. This is what he tells me. He goes, hey, I know about a mansion in northern New Jersey, a mansion, and they have parties and they have women at these parties. I'm going to take you as my guest to one of these parties. And I know the people that are running this stuff. And by the way, the women, prostitutes, they're all Princeton students and other Ivy League type girls. And I'm getting more information about that. This was the dagger that killed that investigation. He goes, and I've seen the governor of New Jersey there. Really? I'm in. Let's go. Can you introduce me to that guy? Of course. On the debrief the next day, they're like, this investigation is over.
Oh,
like, oh. What do you mean?
Yeah. I thought you were going to say Jeffrey Epstein was holding the party.
That whoever, you know, way up the food chain that was making these decisions, that was a bridge too far.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, now, this is a little different where in the Northeast, I've got a lot of friends in the New York, New Jersey area that are investigators for the prosecutor's offices. Mm-hmm. And in the South, you don't see that so much. But you guys are like full-fledged investigative law enforcement authority, carrying guns, locking people up, that kind of thing, right?
It was the golden age for that job. So it was about 120 of us detectives directly for the district attorney. And I got in there in 89 to 98, then went to ATF. There were a large chunk of them that it was you're servicing, you're enhancing cases that are already ongoing. You're finding that extra witness. You're, you know, doing all of these case enhancing, assisting the prosecutor. These are cases that NYPD has already investigated. They made an arrest. Now it's going to trial. And you are now going to try to make that case even tighter. Find that extra witness. You know, all the things that goes into a prosecution. And I did that for a while. And then I said, all right, there's got to be something a little bit better. So the guys running the special investigation unit, proactive unit, they would, of course, assist if asked, but they were tasked directly from the DA, high management. We have this problem. I want a proactive case. I want to be able to say the DA's office drilled that crew. And a lot of times we would work, you know, insular within our unit. Many times NYPD units come in because overlap. And it was fantastic. It was great. As a matter of fact, big DEA guy, I forget his first name, and I watched the podcast. I don't know if it was on you, Del Rey. The guy, he rose through DEA running the Drug Enforcement Task Force in New York City.
It wasn't
Del Rey, I believe was his last name.
It's not ringing a bell. Let's see if I can find him.
But he started in the Brooklyn DA's office as
Frank Del Rey?
Frank Del Rey, yeah.
Yeah, I never knew him. I Googled him real quick and he popped up first.
Yeah, he worked all over the country. Just a good guy. And when I listened to his interview, you just see the Brooklyn. I mean, he grew up in Brooklyn. But he's a guy that, you know, went far. And the DA's office in Brooklyn and the other New York City counties, that was like a breeding ground for federal agents.
Yeah.
And you run into them all over the place. Where'd you get your start? Department of Investigation, the DA's office. You know, it was just an enhancer. You came into a federal agency literally ready to go. You already had the foundational how to interview, how to get a rapport, how to conduct a surveillance, use of electronic surveillance equipment. You had a good overall knowledge where you could hit the ground running. And the veterans that would normally say, it's going to take 3 years just to get this guy to figure out how to get us a sandwich for lunch. And they loved it. It's like, yeah, we're hiring the right people. Every single person in my academy class had either been a detective, a cop, or a federal agent from somewhere else that heard about all the stuff ATF was doing. So a salty group and ready to go.
Yeah.
It was great.
I want to ask you about an incident that occurred when you were with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. When you came out of the building one day, what happened down on the street?
Yeah, great. Again, I was in the Special Investigations Unit, and one of our guys, you know, to give you the quick version of it, one of our guys had done a case, and this is like in 96, mid-90s, crack war, the Colombians were operating in Queens, Ground Zero, but throughout the city with the kilos. I mean, kilos of cocaine. You could literally find them in garbage cans. They were like everywhere.
Sounds like Miami.
Yeah. So one of the guys in the squad, he says, hey, I arrested this guy. I've been looking at him. He had a kilo on him, and I got him in the office. And he proceeds to tell us this fantastical story that he got this kilo from two uniform cops from the 7-5, which is the easternmost precinct in Brooklyn, the killing fields, death store, dangerous. And he goes, yeah. You know, we break the story down and he says, yeah, I am a drug dealer. I bang drug dealers' girlfriends. I am in the know when money's being moved, when kilos are being moved. And I hooked up with these two cops and these are young guys. These are 4-5 years on. They're not, you know, they haven't been around forever. These are criminals that became cops to become better criminals.
Yeah.
They give me kilos. I tell them where stash locations are, kilos, large sums of money. They go in, grab everything. Then we split the money. They give me the kilos. I sell them. Then we split that money. Fantastic. we had a payphone on the wall in the office. And we're like, you're going to make a recorded call now because I want to hear this. Uh-huh. We called the desk of the 7575, Sergeant so-and-so. And now we got our cooperator on the horn. He's like, yeah, so-and-so there. Oh, he's right here. And he goes, I got another one. And we've given him a script. And they go, yeah, well, we're doing a day tour tomorrow. So it's going to be after 4 o'clock. And I'm like, okay, they're a little predisposed to commit this crime of robbing, burglarizing kilos of cocaine and money. Good. We controlled the 3-story apartment. We had a safe, keys to the apartment, how to get into the safe. Bird Brain cooperator tells these two cops, there's a few kilos, there's going to be a lot of money, and they're not going to be home at this time. Boom. Cops go in, the big video of their face going into the safe, taking out 2 fake keys and 50 grand cash. Split the money. They give the kilos. They give our kilos back to the cooperator. He said, yeah, sell them and we'll whack that money up. Good to go. So we were like, well, that happened.
Wow.
That happened. So we go, okay, deal number 2. You're going to tell them that you know a courier that's moving 300 grand from A to B. It's not, he's a courier. That's it. He moves money. It's not, you know, an arch criminal. Good. They're going to do a car stop on duty and relieve this guy of 300,000. And back in those days, who knows better than you, Steve, pulling cars over with gym bags of money, not uncommon. And the Colombians, they would be like, hey, whose bag is that? Well, I don't know. Not my bag. We say, we're going to take custody of that for safekeeping. You know, might be somebody around that would want to take that. And they would start shaking. And they knew to ask for one thing. Well, you got to give me a receipt.
Yep.
Like an official receipt that you took this money. Because if I come back with no receipt and no money, I'm going to be tied to a chair and I'll be pieces and parts all over Brooklyn.
Exactly.
So we used to tell them, you know what? No receipt today. A little bit of information and we'll think about a receipt. But, you know, and people would say, how did you find out about that? Well, that's one of the ways we found out about stuff like that. So anyway, these two cops are good to go. They are going to do a car stop. Grab this courier, 300 grand. I had been with the cooperator all night in a hotel room with another detective because this guy is in pocket. He's not going anywhere and he's not calling anybody either. So we got him, bring him into the office. And we're getting ready. And I just happened to say to the boss, I'll go get the BMW that we're going to use for the undercover. I'll get it ready. I'll get it wired up. We'll do the whole thing and, you know, we'll get out of here. We'll brief it up and get out of here. Good. So when I come out of the building with, you know, the PD radio in my hand and looking like every other plainclothes guy with the leather jacket and all of that, and there's a guy right in front of our building. This is where like 300-400 cops a day are in and out, directly next door to the Brooklyn Law School. It's Martin Luther King Day. Martin Luther King Day, 1996. I mean, thank God it was 1996 and not 2006 for, you know, the uproar.
Right.
Al Sharpton is holding a protest march. He's going to shut the Brooklyn Bridge down. Fantastic. So 10:30 in the morning, I come out of the front doors of our building and I see a guy waving like a transit summons. Like he jumped over the turn. So where do I pay this? And I'm like, black guy. It's like Martin Luther King Day. It's no government offices open today, but tomorrow. And I point with the radio. This is where you go. I never saw the second guy. Second guy just hits me so hard from behind. I've never been. He basically shatters my nose off the jaw connector or whatever. And that was as good as it got for me. That was the opening salvo. and the original guy with the ticket. I never saw this, but a bus driver witness says as soon as this whole fight situation started with you, that guy pulled out a gun, stayed there for a few seconds, and then ran. Was he connected? Because he ran when I started in with this guy, like, hey, I'm a cop, moron. Get on the ground. And there was no getting on the ground. He never said anything. And it was just the fight was on. I was not winning. There was blood everywhere. And I'm trying to throw out a help call on the radio. Radio kicked out of my hand. A busted tendon. Finally, get this guy off of me. Now we're both standing up. He's shoved out to like the curb sidewalk. And I have my gun out. And I'm like, get on the ground. Stop. Police, don't move. Yeah, police, don't move. And this guy just looks at me right into the waistband, charges at me in that like football position, tackle. And I'm like, that's it. Boom, boom, boom. Two to the chest, one to the head. Boom. He goes right down. I got two good upper chest shots, but because of his position, they both like exited his lower back. So they traveled through like 20 inches of him. Lost a kidney, chunk of liver, a bunch of intestine, his spleen. My headshot went through his hat. Good for him. It was just fine for me too.
Wasn't his day to die.
He went down and, but I got blood everywhere. There were uniformed guys around the corner investigating a burglary. They came running around. A fire truck was around the corner. They came over and one of the firemen had just went to the fire department from the police department to get away from this kind of stuff. And here he is. But the first uniformed officer, he starts screaming into his radio. It's like, there's a cop shot in the face, cop shot in the face, confirmed, confirmed. Well, you put that over confirmed cop shot in the face.
Everybody's
the
coming.
Yeah. Aviation, highway, emergency service, every ambulance in like the surrounding five precincts, the entire world came to that. And now I'm trying to say, I'm not shot. You don't know. I'm like, okay, all right, fine. I'm just going to sit here. There were two detectives that had made the turn from where this protest march was on Mark Carr. They just made a collar and they had this guy in the back seat. And they roll up. And I never forget. I mean, this whole scene is going on. I'm like, you know, half out of it. And the detective comes up and he goes, hey, kid, got nothing to worry about. See you in the grand jury. Good job. Little did I know that him and his partner, basically like one of those in slow motion, they're watching this thing as is the handcuff perp. So I talked to this guy later down the road and I did see him at the grand jury and he goes, the guy in the back seat that we arrested starts screaming after, you know, was stopped. He goes, I saw everything. I want to be interviewed. I'll test this kid. So this arrest, this career criminal guy, you know what his statement was? That cop waited too long to shoot him. I would have shot him right away.
I'm like, well, that's good for you.
I'm like, winning. Yeah. So I was out of work for 16 months, operations put back together. I said, make me look like Travolta. Try your best.
Well, they did a good job. Yeah. I see it.
But I get told, hey, we can medically retire you if you don't come back in a year. I said, hey, I want to go to ATF. I can't go as a three-quarter medically retired cop. They're not going to take me. What little did I know, there actually were a few cops that were medically retired and got into ATF. But they said, okay, yeah, we like you, kid. We'll just come back when you can come back. And, you know, the rest was history. That was in 96, 98, I went to ATF.
What happened to the perpetrator, the guy that hit you?
He lived. He lived. He got 1 year in jail. He was out of jail before I was back to full duty. And as soon as he gets released, he was living up in the Bronx at that time. He commits this vicious rape. Mm. And he got a huge chunk of time off of that case. But then I, you know, so I'm hearing about this and I'm like, you know, if I killed this guy, this victim would not have had to go through that. Cause I actually had felt kind of good that I didn't kill him. Right. Not that it would have, you know, that I did something wrong and now I got to live what I killed somebody. But even though this guy richly deserved what he got, I was glad that I could say, I've not killed somebody, you know? So that was good. And you know what? Only cops think like that. Like, he talked to any of these other gangsters.
The guy in the back of the detective's car. I'd have popped him earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you waited too long. Yeah. Yeah. We like to call that trying to de-escalate the situation.
Exactly. Exactly. There, when you were talking about the cops, the dirty cops there at the 7-5, you know, we say anytime that there's a corrupt cop out there, our saying here on Game of Crimes is nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
So true. I can't remember the name of the DEA guy who hooked up with Joe Hall, 7-5 detective. Joe Hall was investigating a bunch of El Compania, Dominican drug-related murders. The DEA agent had like the DEA end of it. They team up together, and the two of them, with help from others, drilled the Mike Dowd corrupt case out of the 7-5. That was like an NYPD guy from the detective squad in the same precinct, teamed up with a DEA guy, and they crushed that entire little cell of uniformed guys that were, I mean, the balls on these guys doing armed robberies in uniform, burglaries. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. I met Dowd at a conference out in San Diego a couple of years ago. And just when I found out who he was, actually, we were in the green room because he was a speaker, believe it or not. And everybody in the green room just turned their back on him, just literally physically turned around away from him.
A shining example of back in those days, that blue wall of silence sort of was alive and well. Like, a good cop, like when I say a good cop, us, you know, ethics, we're going to do things the right way.
Yep.
Their response would not be to get involved and I'm going to start making internal affairs notifications. I'm going to tell the sergeant what's going on. A good cop would just say, you know what? I'm driving on with the way I do business and I'm not going to be with those guys. I'm not hanging with those guys. I'm doing nothing with those guys. I'm not even going on a fishing trip with these guys. I want nothing to do with them. I'm doing my thing with the other good cops. Whatever they're doing, they're doing it. And I don't want to know about it. And that's where it would end. Where today, you will absolutely have other cops that are not going to tolerate that conduct. And that's good. I think really good. And just so, you know, the two uniformed guys, you know, doing these drug rips, I don't think there was no press. There were no big press conference arrests. These guys were drilled, soak dead silence. There were other cops in the precinct might not have even known what happened to these guys. I mean, the NYPD, as phenomenal as they are at what they do, the high command image, they do not want yet another. And Dowd even made reference to that. It's like after they took the 7-7 precinct scandal down, I knew that they didn't have the appetite for yet another scandal in the 7-5. And he was right. He was absolutely right. But that is not the way it is today. And even the rare ATF agent that did something outrageous. And when I say outrageous, I mean like stealing money at a search warrant. That actually happened once. His guys grabbed him in front lawn He was handcuffed and all his ATF stuff. They took how many tens of thousands of dollars out of his BDUs. Wow. And they're like, yeah, no, we're not dealing with that. And that was like a brand new guy, another guy that became an agent to be a criminal.
Yep. Nothing to do with those people. That's that thin blue line we talk about. And they stepped across that line.
Yeah. The peer pressure is to perform, and the peer pressure is, you know, we had general orders in ATF, and the first general order was you will not lie, cheat, or steal, and you will not tolerate anybody that does those things.
Absolutely.
And if you knew about it and you didn't say something, you were going to be in the same predicament as the guy that was doing the bad thing. So,
yep. If you take that oath and you betray that oath, you belong to go. You need to go under the jail.
Yep. Yeah. No, there is no sympathy. Now, I did have sympathy for some of the other things that agents get in trouble with: the car, women,
the G car, yeah,
the drinking. Whenever somebody was in a jam, as we say, and I would always say, what kind of agent was this person? Do we want to throw the life vest or a barbell? You know, it always came back to this minor little thing. You're not getting fired. You're not, you know, a DWI. You're not going to jail. But there's all these administrative, things. And you could make things horrible. Or you could, you know, we're going to try to lessen the pain for you. Yeah. Like, you're going to get 30 days on the beach. We have fantastic undercover in Brooklyn, gets arrested for DWI and the G-Ride. And this guy, everybody loved this guy. And the SAC basically said, okay, just tell us which 2 week blocks you want a vacation. Like, we're going to break it up. We'll do it at your convenience. Summertime, you want to go somewhere. You know, that was a guy, you know, we throw the life vest to, not the barbell.
Yeah.
But running elite task forces around the country, I didn't have any of that. I had high performers, and the peer pressure was to perform. And you didn't want to be the guy that said something stupid in the squad room. It was a shark attack.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I lucked out. The groups that I led, tougher, smarter, everything better than me. What I brought to the table is creating a free fire zone for them to operate. Oh, you need something? Yeah.
I'll get it for you.
We're going to get what you need.
Then that's what a boss is supposed to do, in my opinion, especially a first line supervisor, is you're not the one making the cases now. You're the one that's taking care of your people so they have the tools that they need to go do the job.
I give you a quick example. You interviewed Croak. So when he was doing that UC with one of the pinnacle events in that, a very particular piece of gear was needed to, you know, video, audio, this event. And I was the second GS that had been brought into that case. And then there was yet another GS that ultimately concluded the case with him. But I do the right thing, Steve. I'm like, I go to my technical operations guy who, if you could find them the 3 hours a day that he was in the office, yeah, we don't have one of those. Huh. Fantastic. Good for you. His next sentence should have been, but I'll get one.
Exactly.
Now, pulling around, you know, the little GS-14 mafia guys that I know. You got one. Nobody's got one. Or it's, hey, dude, it's being used right now. We can't give it up. Okay, good. These people don't know what I do. Yeah. I call up the chief of our special operations division, technical operations branch, in his little secret squirrel building in Virginia. And I'm like, and I knew this guy. I'm like, hey, I need one of these things. He's like, bro, all being used. No God. no prize for you. So I'm like, I knew the guy, Attila, that ran Adaptive Digital Solutions in Newport Beach. And we were using his gear. Like when I had the task force in Brooklyn, we were on the phone with this guy so much, telling him, oh, this was great. This was great. Can you do this? Can you do that? He would send us the latest, greatest piece of gear. And he would test and evaluate it for a few minutes. Just hold on to it. Just FedEx it back when you're done. Don't lose it. But
yeah.
So I had a relationship with this guy. I called him up on like a Thursday or Wednesday or Thursday when this thing came up. And I'm like, hey, Attila, I need this. I can't even say with that, like offline, you'll know what I'm talking about, but yeah. I need this thing. And this thing cost, you know, $55 or $6,500, the government cost. And I'm like, listen, I'm going to go to the bank. I'm going to get a cashier's check. I'm going to FedEx it to you, but I need you, as soon as we hang up, I need you to FedEx me this thing. And I'm going to get it to Kroll. I think he was doing this deal over the weekend, I think, if I remember. So, you know, agent cashier, you can't use that to buy investigative equipment, electronic equipment. You got to use the government credit card and it's got to go through all these layers of approval. And it's not even, I'm not even supposed to be doing that stuff. They have people that acquire our ES gear, except nobody is acquiring what I need. So I'm like, I go into my own agent cashier box. I had like 35 grand at any one time to buy guns, pay informants, blah, blah, blah. And I take out whatever, the 55 or 6,500. I go to the bank. I get a cashier's check. On the money request, Steve, it's my name. I'm asking for it. I'm approving it. I'm getting it. I'm sending it. Violate every piece of the order. But I get the gear. And Croak gets the gear. I don't even know if he wound up using it, but I got what he needed, in my estimation. My ASAC calls, and he's like, you know, when he gets my money report, because I didn't even call. I mean, I should have called to ask permission, but when you know the answer is no, don't call, because you
ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah, hey, you don't want to do something after the boss says no. So I didn't ask. I just did. And he called me up. He's like, what's wrong with you? He's like, what did you do? Do you know how much trouble? And I'm like, and I tell him the whole story. I'm like, hey, everybody who was supposed to help me wouldn't or couldn't or whatever. So I helped myself. I helped the undercover who needed something. This goes all the way to headquarters. The chief financial officer for ATF now is calling me direct. Thank God this guy had been a hard charging street agent before going into management. And he's already been told the story from one point of view, not mine. And he goes, just tell me what you did. Why did you do it? Tell me your story. I tell him the whole story. He goes, I get it. Your guy needed something and you did what almost no other supervisor would be willing to do. You executed, you got him the gear. Good. He goes, I'm going to send you a check for all of that money. Cash it, put it back in your box. This never happened. And by the way, don't do it again. Okay. Thank you. And a few other things about doing things that guys need. And I'm like, I try to play by the orders, but when the orders don't work for me, I get my people what they need. My going away party from New York to come out to Kansas City. Howie Stern, love that guy. Hardest working agent in New York City. Howard Stern, his real name. Yeah. One of the funniest guys you would ever want to meet. But he makes up the flyer and MCs this whole event, this cast of 200 lunch. And he puts on top of my flyer, like the biggest words on the flyer. He goes, give Eric a rule, he'll break it. Give him a chance, he'll take it. And that really summed up. I'm like, hey, I had political capital from all the good things that we had going on. And if my guys needed something, I got it.
There you go. I mean, that's fantastic.
I would go to these boss conferences, these GS14 national conferences, and I would they, you know, the typical high command from headquarters. It's like, hey, does anybody have any questions? Is there any need that anybody has identified that would be helpful to all of us in the room? First hand in the air at every one of these. And I'm like, yeah, I have one or two things. And I would tell them, I'm like, because I was an operator on our special response team. It's like, I need the 10 and a half inch barrel M4 that the SRT has. The field agents, M4s, 16 inch in a car, which is our office. It's like, it's a little unwieldy. I need the short barrel. And a suppressor would be nice too. And these guys from headquarters would look at me like I was a Martian, like I'm a cancer cell that somehow got into ATF. They're like, no, that is never happening. And then I would say, oh, by the way, my task force officers, I need them to have ATF radios in the TFO car. I need them to have emergency equipment and all of that. And this is what one guy from headquarters said in front of everybody. He goes, do you know how much that costs? And I'm like, I can tell you how much an agent's funeral costs.
Yeah, exactly.
Because my guy in Long Island that was shot and killed apprehending an armed robbery suspect, that funeral was like $33,000. You know how much ATF paid to that? Zero. No component in ATF to pay for a line of duty funeral. I made friends with the funeral director and I said, hey, how soon do you need this money? Because I am not going to the widow and telling her that there's this $33,000 bill coming. And he goes, a year. Can you do something in a year? I'm like, yeah, good to go. Well, I start utilizing all these services in New York for crime victims. And then I find out, oh, if you're a crime victim, victim of a murder, which is exactly what this was. Oh, we'll provide up to this amount for a crime victim's funeral. And then I go to Social Security. They have a component to pay for a crime victim. So I'm finding all of this government money that's available to crime victim. Good. I think I got like 31 out of the 33 paid. Wow. To the funeral home. And the horror of it was a month, not even a month, 3 weeks before my guy was killed, his mom died. The funeral, the viewing, the same room 3 weeks before that we all went for his mom. I mean, it was like tragedy on top of tragedy on top of tragedy. And then his widow, you know, I finally tell her this story and she goes, hey, I'm going to take care of the other little bit of money. You've done more than enough on, yeah, in that regard. Okay. Yeah. I felt bad that it was that she would have to send a check for 50 cents, much less, you know, like $2,000 or something. But, you know, another example, and I'm sure any other boss would have absolutely done the same thing to try to help. But yeah, that's the attitude I had, Steve. It's like, if my guys need something and it's in my power to get it or, you know, somehow get it. Well, I'll tell you another great DEA story. Oh, talk about taking care of people. I had the task force in Brooklyn. We do this initiative in the 7-3, which is right next to the 7-5. But we're working in the 7-5, 7-3, 7-7 because we're working with the housing cops. I think it was before the merge. There's like 40 housing projects in that east-west line, 7-7 to the 7-3 to the 7-5. It's just horrible. I mean, horrible that any kid would have to grow up in these. Not, I didn't even grow up in one that was as bad as these. Mine was bad, but not that bad.
Wow.
And so I'm working with these cops and a deputy inspector, CO of PSA2, Police Service Area 2, which is the housing guys that covered all these. And when we're doing ops and you know, you want to get a photograph of the TAC plan, the operational plan, like here is a daytime colored photo of the relationships, the parking lots, the buildings. And, you know, if we have a guy squirts out of containment, you know, where do we need to be? We're working off the original blueprints, like from Robert Moses days when this stuff was built. And I'm like, would color photographs of what this looks like today? Cause I know it didn't look, it you know, parking lots and all public areas. Oh my God, dude, anything you could do. Love you long time. Challenge accepted. And again, we have a whole order on air ops. Got to write memos up the chain to get money spent, to get this done, pictures, whatever, anything having to do with an aircraft. Well, F that. I knew, and I wish I could remember this guy's name. He was a pilot of a helo out of JFK, DEA, but I think he actually sat out in Long Island. And I called him up and I'm like, hey, these cops, we can do a really great thing for these cops. Can you just go take, you know, we'll take a bunch of photographs and we'll, you know, make a good thing, give to the cops. He's like, oh, done. He goes, I'll let you know. Okay. I don't think anything of it. He comes in a few weeks later, binders, color photo, 42 housing projects.
Wow.
Here's all the DVDs. They can manipulate the data any way they want. Here are 3-foot by 6-foot, wall maps, wall photographs of this project, that project. And I'm like, oh my God. I go into the bosses at PSA 2 and I'm like, kaboom, here you go. DEA, they're the ones that did all of this. I don't even know how they did it. And they were like, it was like an 8-year-old kid that got the new bike at Christmas. They couldn't have been more thankful. And get a call from ATF headquarters very soon after. And they go, hey, did you call DEA to fly an air mission for you? I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, I know a guy in the pilot and he said, no problem. I knew it was going to be a big problem. And they go, we just got a $13,000 bill from DEA. Jet fuel, hotel rooms. And, you know, and this whole thing, I'm like, and they're like, you violated every part of the air order for ATF. Don't you know you're supposed to? I'm like, yeah, I know I'm supposed to do it, but, you know, whatever. I knew a guy and he said he would take care of it. And it got taken care of. And then finally, I had to say, if I had done all of this memos, this, that, and it was going to cost this much money, would you have approved it? And they go, yeah, probably not. And I'm like, yeah. Well, there you go.
That's the bottom line.
I call my buddy. I'm like, how did you do this? By the way, there's a $13,000 bill. They're going to pay it, but he goes, oh, I didn't use a helicopter. Oh, no. We used a Learjet with the CIA belly digital camera.
Oh my gosh.
And that particular aircraft was in Bogota. I had it flown back to New York, crew of 4. And there was one fine sunny day in PSA 2 when a Learjet was doing strafing runs over these housing projects to get all these pictures. And I'm like, I owe you a lot of beer for that one. And yeah. He's like, hey, if you're going to do it right. And I wish I could tell you the name of DEA who from Bogota and everything else. But I mean, you've probably been on that plane. Well, not, hey, what's the sense of having the job if you can't help your friends out?
That's right. And if you're going to go big. So, hey, listen, we've been going for quite a while now. So what we're going to do is call a stop for today's episode. Everybody, Eric has agreed to come back tomorrow. We're going to get into more of his ATF stories, one in particular about a murder for hire that I know a little bit about. We're going to know a lot about that case after tomorrow. So be sure to come back. Thank you for joining us here on Game of Crimes. And until tomorrow, look forward to seeing you then. God bless.
It will be its money's worth. Thank you, Steve.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.